Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The military wing of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement declares its readiness to confront the Israeli regime in all territories. South Korea says the North is preparing for a nuclear test, with the U.S. warning it could happen during President Biden's visit to Seoul this week. And the UN Secretary General warns about years of mass hunger and famine as the war in Ukraine worsens a global food crisis. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. The Al-Quds Brigade, which is the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, says its forces are ready for confrontation with the Israeli regime. The resistance group says it's prepared for a war with Tel Aviv in the Gaza Strip, Jenin, or other parts of the occupied territories. It has pledged to continue resistance until the liberation of all Palestinian land. According to Al-Quds Brigade, resistance has grown stronger and more equipped in the past year and is ready to repel any Israeli attack. Israeli forces have in recent months escalated their raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well as the occupied West Bank. The atrocities have led to widespread protests. UK-based pro-Palestine activist group has taken the fight to Israel's biggest arms manufacturer in Britain by launching a series of direct action protests at sites belonging to the drone producer Elbit Systems. Palestine Action have vowed further action in response to the ongoing support Elbit provides the Israeli regime in oppressing innocent Palestinians. Robert Carter reports.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
It's now time for our news review program, where we take a closer look at one of our top stories and discuss it with our guests. Welcome. A South Korean lawmaker warns that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any moment. Following a briefing by the National Intelligence Service, the lawmaker talked about the completion of Pyongyang's preparations for a nuclear test, adding they're only looking for the right time. Meanwhile, the United States has warned that a possible nuclear test could happen while President Joe Biden is in Seoul this week. This is going to be Biden's first trip as president to Asia, and the U.S. intelligence says it's possible that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would stage a provocation after Biden arrives in Seoul late Friday. The U.S. and North Korea have been locked in a standoff over Pyongyang's missile and nuclear tests, which the White House describes as provocative. But the North argues it needs them to protect itself from America. Joining me to discuss that further, we have Paolo Raffone. He is a Secretary General of CIPI Foundation, joining us from Brussels. And also we have Barry Grossman on the line, an international lawyer from Bali. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining this edition of News Review. If I can start with Barry Grossman. Barry, thank you for joining us. President Biden is making his first trip to Asia as the U.S. president amid the ongoing war in Ukraine, the global energy crisis. Also, the two Koreas are at odds with one another. What are the aims of his visit, in your opinion?
Well, that's always the question. I mean, usually when a president travels abroad, it's really to give as almost a ceremonial stamp to the work that's been done long before the president comes in discussing various issues between the apparatus of state and the two countries. So we don't really know the details of those discussions as they unfolded. To be sure, we can expect the president to have something to say about the situation in North Korea. But ultimately, I think the Americans would do well, as would South Korea, to consider what kind of nuclear weapons they keep laying around the house in South Korea with a number of U.S. bases in South Korea and in the region, very often receiving U.S. warships and submarines which contain nuclear weapons. In fact, it's worth emphasizing that North Korea itself is not a signatory to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The U.S. Certainly is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but continues to move nuclear weapons around the world, throughout Europe and other parts of the world, in a manner which arguably violates the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So if the North feel nuclear weapons to defend themselves against outside attacks, that doesn't leave them alone. There's a number of countries who feel the same way, most notable of which, of course, is the United States, followed by France and the UK, the occupation, Israel. We've got India and Pakistan. India itself is not a signatory to the non. So I don't see that Americans can or should be saying about this. I think they would do much better to encourage further discussion between the two Koreas, as ironically took place under the previous president.
Mm-hmm. Let me cross over to our guest in Brussels. So South Korea's new president, at his inaugural speech, said that he wants a denuclearized North Korea, and he proposed an audacious economic plan, quote-unquote, for Pyongyang. What do you think South Korea is planning to achieve?
Well, this is something that South Korea will not achieve, because evidently the forces insisting in the Korean Peninsula are using the division in the Korean Peninsula to maintain the tension in the entire Indo-Pacific region. So the visit by Biden to Japan and Korea signifies an attempt for the United States to compact the Quad, which will meet, in fact, in presence of President Biden. But significantly, countries like India and Australia possibly will not participate for different reasons. India for the rift on the sanctions against Russia, and Australia because of incoming elections. But this will reduce, of course, the relevance of that meeting. One thing is clear is the United States cannot think to keep an hegemonic role in Indo-Pacific without addressing the trade issues, namely with China.
Thank you so much.
It's not by arms that it will be resolved.
Right. Please stay with us. We're going to take a short break and look at some social media reactions to President Biden's visit to South Korea and Japan. Here's the first comment. Biden to visit Japan, South Korea, to give a clear message to China not to do Russia anywhere in Asia. Effectively, the most hilarious headline Reuters can write for 2022. The U.S. standing in Asia has taken a drastic beating, and there is no way the Americans can feel comfortable in Asia. Here's the next comment. Record high border encounters, record high inflation, record high gas prices, record high government spending, record high crime. Biden is sinking this country, and his only response is to visit Asia 7,000 miles away this week. He needs to clean up this mess now. Here's the final comment. Maybe I am optimistic, but this seems a very grim take. If there's a nuclear test, I feel it will be at a not important date to make it seems like quote-unquote normal procedure as they do nowadays with missile tests. I don't see Pyongyang wanting to provoke the U.S. Unnoticed testing is key. Now, gentlemen, let's resume our discussion there. Barry, back to you. Let's just discuss the prospect. How likely do you see the prospects of North Korea carrying out this nuclear test on the same day that President Biden visits South Korea?
I think that's extremely unlikely, if not almost impossible. Whether there are nuclear tests remains to be seen. I would imagine that would be something that would take place well after President Biden visited. And obviously something that will take place deep, deep, deep underground. We're well past the age in which countries do nuclear tests in the sky, tens of thousands of feet above the Earth's surface or in the ocean and whatnot, as was the case during the Cold War. So there's really not a particularly coherent argument to suggest that somehow North Korea should be stopped or prevented from doing these tests, given that they do apparently have a nuclear capacity and they're not a signatory to the relevant test ban treaty. But to answer your question directly, I would be astounded if there was a nuclear test while President Biden was visiting the region.
Paulo, do you agree with Barry on that?
I do, because also, I mean, North Korea moves are not independent completely. There is always some kind of type of go-ahead coming either from Russia or from China. And both of them at this stage are not interested in nuclear tests, although the threat of it could be sufficient. But they're interested in opening a real dialogue with the United States and its allies on trade.
And one last question to you, Paulo. What do you think China's reaction would be after Biden visits Japan and South Korea?
Well, we have already seen some reactions on some of the English publications from China in the past days. I mean, they are signaling a certain irritation to the fact that this visit is a sort of indirect threat to China, especially because of the unclear position that the United States have towards Taiwan. Let's not forget that strange event of changing of wording in the Department of State, where one country principle for China was changed. And of course, China is not now interested in a confrontation military-wise with the United States, but is just signaling that it cannot be just overlooked, the fact that the president is going just next door trying to compact a military alliance, which is the Quad.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining us in this edition of News Review. I've been talking to Paulo Raffone, who is the Secretary General of CIPI Foundation from Brussels, and also Barry Grossman, an international lawyer who joined us from Bali. Thank you so much. Welcome back. The UN Secretary General has warned about years of mass hunger and famine if no steps are taken to contain a global food crisis worsened by the war in Ukraine. Take a listen.
Russia must permit the safe and secure export of grain stored in Ukrainian ports. Alternative transportation routes can be explored, even if we know that by itself they will not be enough to solve the problem. And Russian food and fertilizers must have unrestricted access to world markets without indirect impediments. I have been in intense contact on this issue at the senior leadership level with the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, the European Union, and several other key countries. I am hopeful, but there is still a long way to go. The complex security, economic, and financial implications require goodwill on all sides for a package deal to be reached.
Antonio Guterres was addressing a food security meeting at the UN. He said the war in Ukraine is compounding global food insecurity amid warming temperatures and the coronavirus pandemic. The UN chief said the number of severely food insecure people has doubled from 135 million to 276 million in just 2 years. Guterres said the war in Ukraine threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity. The war and economic sanctions on Russia have increased global prices for food and fuel, especially in developing countries. Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. Russia says nearly 800 more Ukrainian fighters have surrendered in the Azovstal steelworks, their last holdout in the city of Mariupol. That brings to over 1,700 the number of forces in the plant who have put down their weapons after being trapped there for over 2 months. However, Moscow says some 1,000 Ukrainian troops, including top commanders, are still fighting in Mariupol. The city is the biggest Russia has so far captured in the war that began on February the 24th. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
It's 3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those angles, if you could briefly mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past, you know, 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. You know, it is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find it extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day. Not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this." And so began the Intifada.
I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, mm-hmm. Of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. And you know, I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually, for a long time, the only way out of this conflict has been death. Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. Mm-hmm. And all that comes through in the course of the film. Mm-hmm.
Of course, in the documentary, you also see lots of statistics. It was filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show, then, that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that, but it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. Mm-hmm. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. No bees. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu Aglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting, without being able to control it, we are reenacting what happened to us, as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there has been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. It's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect through this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realise the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because even this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and then when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the U.S. government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world, and the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favourable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world, and I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so, and if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic help. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. These are only the most basic of pieces of information that we are able to see a drop in the ocean when it comes to the heritage of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And when you do go through the many ahadith, the many verses from the Holy Quran, you're able to see the wonders of Islam. We will always somehow be dealing with people who do not share the same ideology, do not share the same mindset, but we can still coexist. We're still able to meet the demands and the requirements of the quickly progressing society around us, but not at the cost of our iman or faith. And unfortunately, one of the ongoing discussions that we can see in today's modern world is how can Islam comply with the requirements of modern civilization? And is Islam a threat to today's society, especially in Western countries? And unfortunately, those who are, and we can only brand them as such, Islamophobes, do strongly believe that Islam is at conflict with modern society, and Islam cannot integrate or be a part of today's world because of not only its application of Sharia law, which has turned into a very scary, monstrous topic, but also because the element of violence that is inherent within Islam as a religion. This is an important topic, and I do believe that we have a individual, religious, moral, social duty to try to pinpoint what it is that we stand for as Muslims and how we are able to deal with these things. I think the point that I do want to mention here is that so far in everything that we have gone through in this simple book, very valuable book as well, is that we can live in anywhere, any part of the world, and uphold our religious values without compromising, and also be successful in coexisting with others and not forfeiting anything as far as our belief system is concerned, and also not coercing the other person or the other society or the other community to live in a way that we see to be ideal. Even when it comes to issues of halal and haram as well, you know, when we come across the ayah, lakum dinukum waliya din, you have your religion and I have my religion, and many of the other, la ikraha fi din, many other verses like that, which also need to be explained within the correct context, we can understand that Islam deals with all of these things in a comprehensive way, and also in such a way that we are proudly able to say that we can live with Islam anywhere and everywhere.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. there are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons.
Of the book
by those prophets.
And eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
As you know, so far we're mainly dealing with akhlaqi, spiritual, social points, which is all that this book is about. As for the ahkam and the fiqh and things like that, that's for another area to deal with. Now we're on part four, and part four is the ta'amul, the way we as human beings need to deal with animals, with al-haywan, with animals. And like anywhere else, like everywhere else, Islam has a lot to say about animals. And subhanAllah, again, you know, you really feel that empowerment when you are able to see that Islam is going through all of these areas in detail and speaking about them without any kind of flowering or, if we could say, just slogan usage or things like that. No, it's not. And it's not being put under pressure, you know, becoming a vegan and doing this and doing that. You know, Islam doesn't say that you need to be on this side of an extreme, nor do you need to be on that side of an extreme. And from what we are able to go through here, we can understand a lot of what it is that our religion has to say. Without doubt, we do understand that animals themselves, who have been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, have a benefit, and they weren't created out of vanity or for no reason. And this benefit goes back not only to nature itself, but also to us human beings, where we as human beings are able to use animals in certain positive ways for our own well-being. And there are animals that can provide a lot of assistance and help for our sustainability as human beings, in the positive way, of course. And so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who has created everything, created also animals and sees animals as a ni'mah that He has endowed upon us, and also a responsibility that He has entrusted to us. And for centuries and centuries, we have information that speaks to us about how human beings have used animals, whether it be for cultivation, whether it be for farming, whether it be for transport, whether it be for eating, whether it be for defending one's territory, whether it be for any other kind of human usage. As far as pieces of the animal is concerned, you know, all parts of an animal can also be used: the hair, the skin, the leather, the nails, the horns, the milk, the meat. All of these pretty much become a capital for a human being, especially for a farmer, for a butcher, for the average person who wants to use any of these divine ni'mas given to us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we're going to be mentioning a lot of things, even when it comes to a dog, how Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi used to deal with dogs as well. Inshallah, we will continue on speaking about benefiting from animals in the next segment. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.